technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Our topics today have to do with some more interesting things associated with Windows 10. Interesting things about why you really actually need to use ingress firewall restrictions, even for your home environment. And then tidbits about certificate revocation systems and why that's important to you as a user of supposedly secure websites in browsers. So let's start with some more Windows 10 tidbits, because I know that this is applicable to virtually everyone out there. Most everybody's got a Windows system that is eligible for Windows upgrade. And for those of you that have already done it, kudos to you. Now, your next step to consider is whether or not you want to rebuild that computer from scratch utilizing UEFI boot and the Trusted Platform Module and Secure Boot. Now, if you're not an IT person, then that might be a bit of an adventure that's just too far for you. So I just am glad that you've upgraded to Windows 10, because now you've got a more secure and more stable operating system, so that's fantastic. It's just not quite as secure as if it was rebuilt from scratch. Now, I've done this myself on a few systems, and just as a reminder from the last show, the way that you get your system to be authorized for Windows 10 licensing is to actually do that in-place upgrade one time. You have to do that, because only through that process is the Microsoft licensing server recognizing your hardware, your computer, as the device that is going to be authorized for the Windows 10 licensing. So you have to do an in-place upgrade at least once on that system. Then, if you say to yourself, well, I really want UEFI and Secure Boot with a TPM module so that I can do full disk hardcore encryption. Okay, then what you really need to do is get the Windows 10 Media Creation Tool, which is free, and then use it in order to download an ISO for Windows 10 installation. And that can then be burned to a DVD. Now, I found something rather interesting when you utilize this ISO to rebuild your computer from scratch. What I found was that it prompts you for a license key. But at the bottom of that same screen that's prompting you for a license key, it gives you an option to click to install Windows 10 Pro or Windows 10 Home. And the thing is you can't do an in-place upgrade to Windows 10 Enterprise. You would have to have volume licensing to get Windows 10 Enterprise. Now, the only people that are going to use Windows 10 Enterprise are businesses that need the functionality that is unique in Windows 10 Enterprise. So for most of you, this is that component is not going to be applicable. But I do think it's applicable that you know to expect that the Windows 10 reinstallation boot media will prompt you for a license key, and don't get disturbed by that. There is an option to bypass that by looking lower down in the screen, and it gives you a little link to click on. You click on it and it says, would you like to install Windows 10 Pro or Windows 10 Home Edition? I would always recommend Windows 10 Pro myself, because the Home Edition is just, it just doesn't have adequate quantities of features as far as I'm concerned. So that is some more on that. Now, with regards to the actual upgrade process for the in-place upgrade, what we have been finding is that if you have a Time Warner cable, a cable modem, or fiber optic connection, your Windows 10 in-place upgrade process is going to be benefited quite considerably from that, in that your download will be reliable and speedy. Now, we have tried some other types of upgrades over DSL and found that that was completely unworkable. And you have to realize that DSL is half duplex, which means it can only send or receive. It can't do both simultaneously. The other problem with DSL is that, well, it's just frankly unreliable. I can't tell you how many times I've seen where a command line URL download of something, even a small something like a 30 meg file, will just fail and go corrupt across DSL. I've actually seen a situation where a computer had installed corrupt versions of Microsoft updates because it was on a DSL connection, and the DSL connection was so unreliable. So, well, DSL is just bad news. You should get rid of it. But if you are looking to do a Windows 10 upgrade and you have DSL, no, don't do that. Really, please do not do that to yourself because it will not end well. We have done successful upgrades across microwave internet connections. Now, you may say, well, what the heck is a microwave internet connection? Well, for those people that are out in the country, they basically have two options. They have a satellite that they can get, which is really atrocious. Sat connections are just horrible for just about everything. And then there's microwave. Either way, there is a dish on their house that points to either the satellite or the microwave tower. Now, in the Kenosha-Racine County region, there is a company called Evergent. I think they used to be Wisconsin Internet, and they do provide a microwave-based internet connection, and it's fine. I mean, it's not as fast as a Time Warner cable connection, but it works. And so you need to utilize an alternate method. It works, but it's going to be so much more slower that you need to use an alternate method for downloading the Windows 10 upgrade, and that alternate method would be to utilize the media creation tool. So, on the same topic of Windows 10, every single time there is an underlying operating system change, those of us that manage and maintain systems management platforms end up having to recode the processes and do a lot of testing. It's basically DevOps is what it's called. It's development operations, development of stuff. You develop these processes and then you roll them into operations. So that is one of the things that I do. And as part of Windows 10, what I've been seeing is that ActiveX Flash does not inventory at all, even remotely close to the way that it did in all prior operating systems, including Windows 8. Now, those of you that are in the know, you may realize that ActiveX Flash, because there's two different types of, well, there's actually three different types of Flash. There's Flash for ActiveX, which is for Internet Explorer and Edge. And then there is the NPAPI plugin, which is for Firefox, and then there's another plugin for Chrome. And in general, I just don't even bother with the plugin for Chrome. The NPAPI plugin for Firefox is definitely required, and you most definitely want to keep that updated. And Firefox has a nice feature now where it will tell you if that plugin is out of date, so that's pretty cool. But the ActiveX plugin for Flash for Internet Explorer and Edge, and Edge, by the way, is the browser that is in Windows 10. Internet Explorer is still there, but you get this browser called Edge as well, and that's because Microsoft is eliminating and deprecating Internet Explorer over time. And some people are not happy about that. Okay. It is what it is, and whether or not you're happy about it isn't going to make any difference to Microsoft. So a lot of us have just gotten to the point where, yep, there's four browsers on our computers, and that's the way that it is. So ActiveX plugin, in order to attempt to make this a significantly reduced security vulnerability attack vector, Microsoft and Adobe got together and they decided to collaborate such that on Windows 8 and Windows 10, the ActiveX plugin for the browser would get deployed as a Microsoft update. Now, the interesting thing is that when that Microsoft update gets deployed on Windows 8, And when I say Windows 8, I'm including Windows 8.1 in that same bucket. The inventory methods that have worked on prior operating systems continued to work just fine. But the inventory methods now for the ActiveX plugin are completely different with regards to Windows 10. And it's kind of a completely different mental shift. So for those of you that have to do systems management, pay very close attention to what I'm going to tell you. Because if you look to the internet, you will not find answers to this problem. What you need to do is think about this in terms of saying, well, I understand that the Windows 10 ActiveX browser plugin is actually coming as a Microsoft update patch. So then you might think to yourself, well, maybe I can just inventory search for the installed patches that have the word Flash in them. Well, that would be nice, except the reality is that the vast majority of patches that are out there do not have a friendly name, at least when you interrogate them through something like PowerShell. The only information you are typically going to get is the actual KB article that is associated with the patch. That's it. Now, I don't really think it is wise to construct an inventory methodology that is based upon you constantly keeping up to date this, you know, what this KB article number happens to be, and then interrogate and look for that. So what you have to do is really just change your mental paradigm about this entirely and say, well, okay, I'm managing the Microsoft updates for these systems. So I know that I don't need to separately inventory for ActiveX Flash plugin when the operating system is Windows 10. So that's really the paradigm shift that you need to make. And so, of course, the presumption there is that you are actually doing an excellent job of keeping the Microsoft updates processed and up to date. And that can get out of date real quick. To give you an example, I recently became aware of a situation with a systems management platform that has not been maintained for about a month and a half. That's it, just a month and a half. And that systems management platform has not been maintained because the organization that had that systems management platform managed to hire an IT service provider that is not qualified to provide services. That's my polite way of saying they're probably grossly incompetent. And when an IT service provider cannot provide the most basic services to their client that they're billing them for, and this is the part that really bothers me because I consider it to be fraud, and when they cannot provide the most basic functionality to their client, when the client is paying for those services, then that's criminal in my mind because you're defrauding a client. And so I became aware of a situation where in just strictly a month and a half, the systems management platform not only wasn't getting backed up anymore because things were not being maintained properly, but the systems were behind by 345 patches. Yes, 345 patches. Now, that gap opened within a period of less than 60 days. So if there is the potential for 345 patches to need to be deployed to the systems and I'm talking about, these are unique patches, by the way. This is not 345 instances of the same patch. This is 345 unique patches that may need to be deployed to all of your systems. So if you have, 500 systems, then those 345 patches may need to be deployed to all 500 of your systems. In less than 60 days, you can have that much of a mess on your hands when you are not on top of this. One of the things that I do for my clients is to ensure that their systems are patched within 48 hours of the patch coming out. And I can do that as long as the system is actually online, as long as it's turned on and connected to the internet. And if it doesn't happen to be turned on and connected to the internet at the same time, then it will get patched and processed when that computer boots up. And so that's great. But you need to be aware of the change in the flash inventorying and installation and updating processes with this change for Windows 8 and Windows 10, where flash is now being deployed. At least the ActiveX component is being deployed as part of a Microsoft update. Now, if you are deploying Firefox to these systems that you manage, then you need to still have a good inventory and deployment process for the NPAPI plugin. So, because again, you have to keep that up to date. Anything that interacts with the internet needs to be kept up to date. Let's talk about firewall rules and ingress firewall rules on things like, things at your house. Okay, let's say you have a NAS. Now, there's a lot of consumer-grade NASs out there. There's a lot of them that are, they're literally advertised as plug-and-play, sort of easy-to-install things. I think Western Digital makes some of them, and Synology makes some of them as well, but Synology's devices are actually fairly high-end as far as capabilities. I have not had my hands on one of the Western Digital units. But ultimately, you got to realize that these things, they all have feature sets that are supposed to make it so that if you provide their software, the username and password to your perimeter device, whether that's a wireless router or whatever it is, that it's supposed to be able to go in there and configure the rules that it needs. And now, first of all, it's only going to do that if UPnP is turned on. And I have railed endlessly on this show about why UPnP is lunacy. Don't use it. Disable it. So you then would end up looking at the user manual for whatever your little device is that you want to make remotely accessible on the internet. And you then figure out, oh, I need to have these ports port forwarded to my device. Let's just say it's the NAS. Now, in that circumstance, though, what is preventing people other than you from getting at that device? Well, there's nothing. I mean, under that context, there's nothing. Now, if you have a good device, your optimal situation is where you're using a real perimeter security appliance that can actually have what's called source restrictions on the port forwarding rules. And by the way, port forwarding rules are also called ingress traffic, like inbound ingress traffic. And so your best option is where your perimeter security appliance is smart enough to be able to have that capability programmed in it. However, most consumer-grade devices are not that smart. So what they do typically have is the ability to do port forwarding. So you then, since that functionality is missing, that sort of restriction functionality is missing from the capabilities in your perimeter device, you then need to start looking at, well, what sort of firewall rule capabilities exist inside of the NAS itself? Well, in the case of Synology NASs, they have a very, very nice firewall kind of brute force blocking capability. So they actually have some auto-blocking functionality built into it, which I think is fantastic. And their firewall rule that is literally programmed on the NAS itself is very easy to understand. It's very easy to program. You do need to test it. And please do not lock yourself out. Get some help from somebody if you're not sure how to program that. But it works extremely well. And I think it's fantastic that functionality is available on the device itself in the context that you do not have that sort of source restriction capability through something else that you have, such as your perimeter device. So if your perimeter device doesn't have that functionality, then you darn well better be using the NAS in order to lock down that ingress traffic. Now, if you don't do that, then your device will be attempted to be hacked. It is inevitable. People will sit around and attempt to hack your NAS. And if there's any vulnerability in it, or even just, let's just say there isn't a vulnerability, which I think is a specious claim anyways, because everything has a vulnerability. But let's just, for sake of example, say, well, it doesn't have a vulnerability. But then why, if it doesn't have a vulnerability, then why would I want to restrict access to it? Well, because you want the device to actually be available to provide services to you. You know, so many people think that, you know, they say, well, I don't need some fast computer because I only do this and that and the other thing with my computer. Like, it's not all that important. But the reality is, you do want your computer to keep working. You want your computer to be available to you when you want to use it. And if you do not put enough protections in place on your computer and then maintain it, such as the Microsoft Update patches, such as the Flash patches, then it won't be available to you as a functional device when you want it to work. So the point with that is, it doesn't matter what you want to do with your computer. If you can say, yes, I care about my computer continuing to work so that I can use it as a tool when I want to use it, then you have to be serious about its security, because otherwise bad things will get into it and will break it. Even if you don't care one hair on the back of a rat about the data that you have on that computer, if you desire to have it as a functional tool, then you need to be serious about maintaining it. So the same thing applies with any other device that you are going to present to the internet in any way as a device that's remotely accessible. So this idea of restricting who can even attempt to communicate with that device is incredibly important, because if that device is left accessible to everyone on the internet, then the bad guys will try to hack into it constantly. It's just inevitable. That's what they do for a living. So then what you need to do is to think about, well, how do I, what's the ramifications of that? Well, you say, okay, so now here's my NAS, and I want my NAS to continue to provide services to me, but yet it's busy all day long. It's so busy all day long servicing the attempts of the hackers. So if you leave it open and they have the ability to attempt to talk to it to try to hack it, then they are burning CPU cycles on your NAS. And that's really no good at all. I consider that to be highly problematic. So you need to lock down the ingress rules. Off the show by talking about vulnerabilities in the use of certificates for web browsers. First of all, let's establish what a web browser is. A web browser is an application that is on your computer that you use to interact with websites. So that would be Internet Explorer, Microsoft Edge, which is only available in Windows 10, Firefox, Chrome, and there's other browsers that are on the market, but those are what's called web browsers. Now, you know that when you go to your bank website, there should be a security lock icon. And if the bank has what's called an extended validation certificate, then that EV certificate will actually make the browser bar go green as an indication to you that the website is secured properly, or at least the communications between your computer and the website are secured properly. And I'm sure you've all heard a lot about SSL, which is Secure Sockets Layer, but SSL by itself, just in its native way, is kind of not as secure as it should be. So what the world has moved to is what's called TLS over SSL. And the reason that you couldn't change to just say, well, let's just do TLS all the time, is because every website on the planet that has secure browsing channels has been designed to work over port 443, which is SSL. And you can't start going to some new standard without maintaining some backward compatibility to some other things. And it's just IP network standards, which is kind of like the physics of how the internet works, is all based upon SSL web traffic being on port 443. So the designers of TLS came up and web browsers collaborated to come up with a way to make TLS security work over an SSL channel. So that's important that you know that that's actually what's happening nowadays. When you browse secure websites, you're actually seeing things with TLS layer security, which is transport layer security, which is great. So TLS is actually quite secure. So you know then you're browsing HTTPS, port 443, SSL, TLS over SSL. But then how do you know, based upon the certificate, that connection is actually secure? You don't want to just make some assumption. I mean, we've heard about Heartbleed and the OpenSSL vulnerabilities and a number of vulnerabilities that affect the way in which those communications are done. So are they secure or are they not secure? Well, you want to know. And one of the ways that you know is by utilizing the feedback mechanism that's supposed to be available to you in the certificate system. But the reality that we've been finding is that there's a lot of certificate authorities out there that do not actually process revocations properly. And in some cases, there are browsers that don't even check for revocations. In fact, most mobile devices do not check for revocations at all. So what can then happen is if your web browser, either on your PC or your mobile device, is actually connected to a site that is really no longer having a valid security certificate, your web browser will not tell you that. It will not indicate to you that that is a revoked certificate. So this presents quite the conundrum for people who are trying to browse the internet securely. And there's no real good fix for this at this point in time. I just wanted you to be aware of this, as it's another complexity of the world for you to deal with when you're using computers on the internet. But we are out of time for today, and I hope you've enjoyed the show.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
from the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar. Kenosha County residents may dispose of hazardous waste on Saturday, May 7th.